Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast presentation titled Indirect Trial Comparisons in the Metastatic Castrate-Sensitive Prostate Cancer Space. I'm Dr. Ashley Ross. I'm a urologist at Northwestern, and I'm also the clinical director of the Polsky Urologic Cancer Institute. I'm joined here by two of my colleagues and prostate cancer experts, my co-moderator, Dr. Jason Hafrin, and our guest, Dr. Neal Shore. Dr. Hafrin, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks, Ash. Happy to be here. Jason Hafron. I'm Chief Medical Officer of the Michigan Institute of Urology.
Dr. Shore, thanks for being here as well as our discussant. Maybe say a few words about yourself and your practice.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Neal Shore. I'm a urologist practicing with Atlantic Urology Specialists in Myrtle Beach. And I'm the research director for START Carolinas, which is a part of the more global START Cancer Research Network.
Wonderful. In today's episode, we're going to actually talk about sort of an embarrassment of riches. What we've seen in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer or castrate-sensitive prostate cancer is multiple drugs approved for their oncological benefit. These different androgen receptor pathway inhibitors, such as abiraterone, enzalutamide, apalutamide, darolutamide, that when combined with ADT improve oncological outcomes versus, ADT androgen deprivation therapy alone. And, in an ideal world, when we go to think about, well, which drug would be, or which we would go for to first, or if we want to compare this to a completely different regimen or some of the treatment intensification regimens to each other, we would have direct head-to-head comparisons. But it's unrealistic, to happen. And so we have to sometimes think about indirect comparisons. We have to think about, even comparing to historical control arms. And, we wanted to have a little bit of a discussion about how do we look at that data in our practice. So, I'll start out and ask you, Dr. Shore, that, in terms of metastatic castrate-sensitive disease, how do you think about what your first line of therapy will be for patients, and present them with that with an option between drugs.
Yeah, in our last episode, we touched base on that. So it would be great if folks wanted to go back and look at that episode. But I think it's still an incredibly important question. And as you said, this embarrassment of riches, at least in the US now, right? We have, triplet ADT and Abby and docetaxel, ADT and Darrow and docetaxel. We have ADT. Enza, ADT, APA, ADT, Darrow now. We now have ADT, Abby, Nira, and for BRCA patients. We may have, if addition gets approved, we may have ADT, ARPI, and lutetium-617. And we may have more PARP inhibitors to come, pending TALAPRO-3. And EvoPAR. So it's a really exciting time. We may have a PTEN loss, PI3K AKT oral therapy. So based on the CAPItello trial. So it's kind of like, wild how we went from monotherapy, which is really no longer the standard of care, to making this decision. When it comes to just simplifying it a little bit to just the doublets, and ADT and ARPI, you're absolutely right. I don't think anybody's ever going to do an appropriately powered prospective study direct comparison. And we always have that caveat in when we show tables of publications in great journals from New England to JCO to JAMA to Lancet, J Urology, European Urology, and we look at phase three, wonderfully conducted trials, similar patient populations. In this case, the MCSPC, mostly high volume or combination high volume, low volume, and we say, okay, how did they meet their endpoint? Based upon RPFS, based upon OS, based upon PSA PFS. skeletal-related events, next anti-neoplastic therapy, time to resistant disease. And then, in conjunction with that, what was the tolerability? What was the AE profile? So I don't just pick one. I don't have a just always go to in my ARPI selection. I've done trials with all of these, tremendous drugs in the androgen receptor pathway inhibitor space. And even if you want to include as an androgen receptor blocker, ARB, no one uses that acronym anymore, abiraterone and other versions of abiraterone. And I really think it's the art of medicine where I stop and I look at the patient and I try to figure out, is it pill count? Is there a particular adverse event of interest that this would be very hard on this patient? Is it laboratory monitoring? Is it with or without food? Is it daily BID? And I kind of put all that together. And assuming costs are not an issue and accessibility is not an issue, which is a big assumption. So I think some of our colleagues probably just say, hey, you know what? I'm comfortable with one. I'm going to go with one. I just hasn't been my experience. I probably feel not indebted, but I'm really appreciative to the companies that put these big trials together. These are big undertakings. So I guess that's my most honest way of saying how I do the selection. I talk to the patient, talk to their caregivers about all these different permutations, recognizing that these drugs all have really good clinical efficacy. We can argue that one may look a little better with a hazard ratio on OS than another. One may look a little bit better than another on RPFS. They clearly all have some new differences in their tolerability profiles. And then there's always drug-drug interaction.
Now, those are great points, and I think it's important with everything going on and all the trials that we have out there, that Arches, ARANOTE, TITAN, these aren't competitive or comparative trials. They confirm that doublet therapy works. And I think also what you said is also important. Hazard ratios across trials, show just treatment versus control, not treatment versus treatment. So to your point, hazard ratio of this versus that, you can't compare across a trial. And so essentially, you're choosing these drugs on tolerability, financial toxicity, and things like that. What in the patient, when you're looking at a patient, do you look at? Specifically, is age a factor? How do you assess performance status, cardiovascular risk? I mean, we're seeing more and more, risk associated with ADT plus ARPI with cardiovascular risk. How do you assess this? So what's your, you touched on a little bit, but what's your global gestalt and how you look at these patients, or what should the urologist be thinking about when considering all the options that we have?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about age, and we sort of in a lot of these studies tend to just arbitrarily pick, 75 as, elderly, less than 75, over 75. It seems to be a moving target, the older I get, and also with the graying of the world. But I think most of the data suggests that, the elderly population has a little bit more in terms of the higher adverse event profile issues, but still has great efficacy when their performance status is reasonable. There's some data that's going to come out, and I want to be careful about, because I'm trying to remember, is it having reviewed a paper, or is it because of a conversation I had? But Stopgap, I think, is going to show some interesting data regarding some challenges perhaps with abiraterone in the post-75-year patient population that wasn't so clearly defined in the other androgen receptor pathway drugs. Of course, and we've talked about this earlier, and I look at profiling, their genetic profiling. If they have an SPOP, they may be really good for abiraterone. I look for other alterations that could inform me about a PARP inhibitor. Not so much so really right now with the other three leading ARPIs, but the field's going to get even more crowded with other oral therapies adding into it, such as EZH2 inhibitors and AR degraders. So I think it's very exciting. I really tell patients, look, we can't just give you monotherapy ADT, watch the PSA get low, and declare victory. The data is overwhelming that you have to have an ARPI.
I think oh, sorry. I think it's
I just
great
want
point. Go ahead.
to
Go ahead.
just sorry, just one follow-up. Cardiovascular risk. We're seeing more and more data with cardiovascular risk, MACE. You're involved with with HERO, but the combination of ADT plus ARPI and the risk of cardiac event. How are you managing that in your clinic? How are you assessing cardiovascular risk in this patient population? In Myrtle Beach, are you referring to a cardio-oncologist? If you don't have one available, what can the urologist do to assess cardiovascular risk? I think it's just going to be becoming more and more important as we're going deep into this androgen suppression in these elderly patients.
Yeah, I think it's such an important question. And I don't have a cardio-oncologist. I'm in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The nearest tertiary academic center to me is, Duke. It's 3 hours away. MUSC is 2.5 hours.
Ashley probably has three of them in his
Ashley
center.
probably has three cardio-oncologists and four neuro-oncologists and a genetic counselor and a GU nutritionist all in the same floor with him. I mean, but it is, look, we all want to emulate the academic medical center model, and we try the best we can, but we have real person power shortages in the healthcare system now, and so we have to learn more as specialists. I mean, I really believe that, one of the, in your practice, I know this is true, Jason. We can't be generalists. Those days are long gone. You've got to have the prostate cancer champion, the bladder cancer champion, and he or she. It's going to be really hard for them to be really, also expert in BPH treatments. It's you got to really focus. So there's that. And getting back to cardio-oncologic, look, there's just these patients by nature, by the fact phenotypically they're men, higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They're older, another risk. Typically, they have hypertension and or hyperlipidemia. Oftentimes, they're sedentary. They're deconditioned. They may be smokers or drinkers and the family history of cardiovascular disease, and then we lower their testosterone, and which clearly has been shown to have a cardio-oncologic negative effect. I'm proud of the work we've done with relegolix because we and it started with degarelix, but it really kind of came forward in the HERO trial. Although there's some challenges and lack of central adjudication, et cetera. But we were really starting to see the cardio-oncologic potential benefit of an antagonist over an agonist. And our colleagues should really read this recent JAMA Cardiology paper by Patel, Sagar Patel et al. That came out of Emory. It's a small study, but they looked at some computerized angiography of antagonist versus agonist. It's a really very fascinating study, sort of setting a predicate for the pathophysiologic anatomical etiology for coronary vascular challenges that you see and why there may be a benefit to an antagonist. So I don't have, it's like a 6 to 8 month visit to get into a cardiologist in Myrtle Beach. The only way I get people in is if they're going to be on near death's door to get them in. And that's just my experience. It's sad, frankly, the healthcare system. That said, I get baseline EKGs on virtually everybody, even if they're not going into a clinical trial. Most will have a PCP, but if they don't, I'll get a hemoglobin A1C, and then I try to get them into a PCP, and maybe hopefully they get some additional stress testing. I talk always at every visit about the importance of nutrition and exercise. We all want to look like Ash. Ash is like, he's a pinnacle of, He's like Charles Atlas. He looks great. He's fit and trim. But you got to eat well. You got to be on a cardiovascular, heart healthy diet. I tell patients, own your diet, heart healthy, and exercise. 15 to 20 minutes of cardio, 15 to 20 minutes of aerobic, 15 20 minutes of cross resistance. The data on that's overwhelming. Just those basic holistic things. And then APPs. We're working on trying to get our APPs potentially more involved in both cardio-oncologic and neuro-oncologic assessments and clinics dedicated to that.
Just curious, I think, and for the audience out there, because all of these drugs, I know that there's, like we said, there's no comparisons between them, but all of these drugs that improve, some of them have been proven to improve overall survival. So you know that they're benefiting the patient, but almost across class, they are associated with cardiovascular, increased in cardiovascular risks, in at least hypertension. And I think certainly to my eye, even ischemic cardiac events. And so it becomes crucial, as these are going to be part of everybody's daily, practice, even if you send it to your specialty prostate cancer expert, that man coming in, you should know what their lipid profile looks like, what their blood pressure looks like, what their A1C is, that they at least have an internist. And then as you put them on these therapies, it is incredibly important, I think, to follow those, particularly in the short term, and see if something is getting out of whack. As Dr. Shore said, look at the drug-drug interactions up front too. Some of these drugs are metabolized the same way as statins. Some of them you might have to make an adjustment to their statin, work with their internist. And in some cases, I know here at Northwestern, we've had some of our APPs actually interface a lot with internal medicine to become sort of expert at how do we ju adjust some of these other medications that have to be adjusted. It's an incredibly important point that you're bringing up. The I wonder, when we're talking about one thing we talked about earlier was that there's these all these different drugs out there, and when you talked a little bit of how you select them, there's data that has come out trying to sort of match patients together. And ideally, if you try to, one thing that comes up is that we no longer is ADT the standard of care. And because of that, in the United States, it's impossible to use that as your active comparator arm. It's just not ethically appropriate. Sometimes matching patients to make a comparison makes sense. I think particularly when you have very granular patient level data, you're one of the leads of there was a kind of a single arm trial, ARASEC, which looked at darolutamide and compared it to a historical ADT arm. It kind of followed on the heels of ARANOTE, which was a true randomized trial ex USA where ADT could be appropriate control. Maybe talk about what's your sense of matching and use of that matching in that trial, if you're willing, and maybe how people should interpret the results when you do that. Could this accelerate approvals in the future? What do you think of the matching in that trial?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question because, when we did ARANOTE, we didn't have any US sites because it would seem wholly unethical to have a control arm of monotherapy ADT in an MHSBC population where you already had, three approved drugs for MHSBC, not even including, triplet. So we couldn't give monotherapy. It was just flat wrong ethically. The study enrolled outside the United States and in a lot of countries where accessibility and approvals are not as liberal or as fortunate as we have here. And Fred Saad led that. I was fortunate to be on the steering committee. And that was obviously a positive trial with the primary endpoint of being RPFS. And really didn't really have the ability to follow those patients out, power it out to overall survival, which some would say, well, wait a minute, we want to see OS. And I understand why some would say that you already have OS benefit in other darolutamide trials, but still, we didn't see that there. We wasn't powered for that. So with Arisec, we designed Arisec while Arinote was being designed as well. And so we didn't have the results of it. And what we did was we went to the FDA and we said, look, we want to get US patients to get on ADT and darolutamide, approximately, a large study, but we want our comparator arm to be the monotherapy arm from the CHARTED trial, because we were able to access that because it was a cooperative group study. A lot of times you can't access a lot of the data when it's industry-sponsored studies. So A, the data was available, so it was just a practical consideration. One can argue, oh, well, it's an older, that paper came out, I think, like in 2017, so it's an old, it's a 10-year-old population. Maybe some of the definitions and the constructs of the MedDRA definition dictionary were a little bit different. Yeah, that's not unreasonable, but we still were able to then do, and the FDA agreed to it, which I thought was very forward thinking of the FDA. They said, go ahead and do this study and do what's described and as a match adjusted independent comparison. I've done this study and a few other types of these MAICs or MAICs, and I don't try to come across as a biostatistical expert, far from it. I just probably know enough to be dangerous having done these. They tend to start to get a little bit wonky in the weeds of the definitions, but the bottom line is you want to take patients in your therapeutic arm. It was an open label ADT Darrow high and low volume patients, and Ash, you were on the steering committee as well. And so what we did was we had to look at things that we thought were going to be of clinical relevance: age of the patients, histopathology, and several other parameters, and you try to match them as best you can to your control arm. And the more number of matches of those metrics, the tighter the confidence you have, or what we describe as using what are called calipers. And we have not yet presented the data. And here's a sort of a, I don't know when this is going to be published, but we have now just recently, and this is public knowledge, but we were accepted for a plenary presentation at the AUA for this year, in mid-May. And I'm super excited about it. You're a co-author, I'm a co-author. Raina McKay will give the presentation. We have the work on it is in submission for a publication. I don't know if we'll be able to pull off a simultaneous publication, fingers crossed. But I'm excited about it because this was a pure US study. The data's never been presented before. We've published on the methodology of the MAIC in a separate publication, but this is the first time we're going to show the data. And I'm super excited about it. I mean, it's novel in the way we designed it. Now, this becomes important because, and to the FDA's credit, they said, go ahead and do this. So we only had to have, I think it was approximately a couple hundred patients, as opposed to a lot of our trials, our big phase three trials, 1,000 plus patients. So it takes a lot of time, it takes enormous expense. So I'm always in favor of trying to figure out ways that we can get answers to novel therapies in a quicker period of time. And if we can do it in a way that saves the healthcare system, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful point. And I think that just for the listeners out there, we have to understand the spectrum. And it was kind of mentioned all through this discussion, but the spectrum of these kind of comparative trials when you don't do a completely direct comparison. Probably the least fair is what Dr. Shore said a long time back in this discussion, where he said, like, you're looking at a hazard ratio from one trial versus a hazard ratio from another trial, and you're doing a completely indirect comparison across these trials, that's subject to a large amount of error. On the other end is what he just talked about for Arisec, where you have like individual patient level data, you're doing a matching and trying to do a caliper adjusted matching on multiple factors that you know will drive the outcome from previous experience and trials, and saying, like, we're going to pick, patients that we can almost match this guy to that guy, this guy to that guy, and be really direct. And then there's this like sea in between, the sea in between that, at least for myself, of sort of like, indirect, still, matching adjusted indirect comparisons, but maybe using aggregate data versus individual data, maybe, just adjusting on a couple factors. In my practice, I find all of those other publications, which they're very good. Dr. Shore's done some of them. There's a recent one by Dr. Armstrong. They're mostly like hypothesis generating for me. And as you had mentioned earlier, Neil, if I have a patient where I'm on the fence about like, well, do I want to do this thing? It might be a little more toxic, but maybe the efficacy in this subpopulation, and I need a little bit of help to push me one way or another. That's when I'll sometimes look at that data, but I find it very exploratory. There's obviously efforts to do actual comparisons, there's Eric Hogg, for example, looking at darolutamide versus enzalutamide for cognition factors. But those are all small studies. You said it so well. You said, I don't think we're ever going to see an appropriately powered study that's going to compare these things together. And it's going to come down to, kind of your gestalt, but also all these other factors. What do they have access to? What's the cost? What do they, can it come in less doses per day for their pills? So that's kind of, I just wanted to kind of expand on that a little bit. I don't know, Jason, if you have any other comments around that area to throw in.
No, I think it's important that the audience knows that there's more and more of these trials being done. I mean, I think you got to look at it. It's not this hierarchy of one drug versus the other drug, because that can only be assessed in a randomized controlled trial. I think it, like you said, it helps contextualize or helps maybe make a decision. But it's not a tiebreaker that overrides trial level evidence or patient-specific tolerability we see in a randomized controlled trial. But it's important to and thought-provoking or hypothesis generating to have these out there so we can understand a little bit more. But I think we got to get away from this, which drug is better. I think because they're really not armed or powered or designed to do that, and we'll never see that data because no one's going to do or very rarely a head-to-head randomized control trial looking at this. So I think it's I think we have to be good consumers as urologists of this data, look at the methodology, and be very cognizant of the differences between a MAKE trial, a RCT trial, real-world evidence trial. Because the quality of the data, the quality analysis is very different, as much as they don't always match what the conclusion or what people want us to believe.
I think that like maybe two sort of things for Dr. Shore as we get towards the end here. One is as you said, I like the idea that we can use these things to accelerate, discovery and particularly to confirm discovery. Like, we didn't do ARANOTE in the United States. How can we use a system if ARANOTE is positive that people would say, well, we can accelerate this here? And but another question I had that you touched on it earlier. Beyond kind of this accelerated path where we say, okay, we want to adopt this in a different context. We see that it worked in like Europe or ex-USA. What level of evidence do we need to work in the USA? Like another way of saying it is if whatever ARISEC reads out as, if it was positive, would people have accepted it if ARANOTE never existed? That's one question. But the second kind of question, which maybe you could take first, is you talked a lot about overall survival, progression-free survival. Can you talk about when you look at studies or choose a drug, how do you pick when you if only progression-free survival data is there? And beyond these ARPIs, we saw a lot going on in like the RLT world where the trial was kind of agreed upon for progression-free survival, and then it wasn't enough in some cases for the FDA. So I'm just curious how you put that into your decision-making, progression-free versus overall survival.
Yeah, great questions. Let me go back to the first one. I think that I think I you know I can't give you the exact citing, but I think even before ARANOTE and before we'll show the ARISEC data, I think people voting with their feet. I think people based upon ARAMIS and ARASENS were already using darolutamide to some reasonable percentage. in the MCSPC population. So now I personally wasn't, because I'm more data trial driven and label driven. I tend to be pretty conservative that way, but clearly many of our colleagues were not and are not. Medical oncologists tend to write a lot of things off label in more advanced disease. They're much more comfortable doing it, I think, as a generalization, as foolhardy as it may be that I just said that, than urologists. But I think it's always good if you have a drug trial of phase three that has demonstrated OS, and Darrow clearly has in other populations. So I'm glad that we have the Arisec to compare and add to the ARANOTE, and people have their experiences. In an ideal world, yeah, I mean, OS, you know, it's about the most binary thing you can get. You know, you're either alive or you're not. And there are always some challenges in local RPFS interpretation versus central review, et cetera, types of imaging and imaging variability. But, you know, we do the best we can in making these decisions. And so I think, you know, that was the issue of needing RPFS OS. And what was that last part of your question that I just.
You kind of answered it. I think that, like, well, I kind of asked one thing, like, if Arisec stood alone, would have it led to an approval? Is that really a mechanism? But you sort of answered that, and you answered the other one too. When I look at trials that have progression-free survival as their primary endpoint, what I look at is two things. I look at, did they meet that endpoint? And then, because I'm not going to get OS easily, either because the trial was, like you said, done all around the place, they couldn't get those outcomes, or because people are going to switch, onto the active comparator or whatnot, I tend to look at, like, how, quote unquote, beat up were the patients, in, or eligible were they for active secondary therapies. You know, obviously there's trials around sequencing, but like you mentioned, for some of these ARPIs, and we've had this in another session, their quality of life outcomes are preserved, and as time goes on, even superior to if you did like an 82 alone or something like this. And so, because they're not getting beat up on that first line of treatment, it means that they're very eligible for, all these subsequent lines. And so I have to believe in my mind that, like, the OS would be there. Again, I'm a little bit less of a purist than you are, but that's kind of what I think about when I have a trial powered for RPFS. I really dig into the toxicity data and what did the patients look like as they were exiting the trial, and the PROs become even more and more important. What's their functional performance status, looking like? Sequencing will always be an issue, but I think that meaning when you give what, but as you said in one of your previous sessions, you try to lead with your best, first step, that's kind of how I put it together.
No, that's a great point, Ash. You know, it's the nuances that, as a trialist, that you and Neil appreciate so much. I think what we had such a great discussion tonight. I think indirect comparisons are most valuable when they sharpen clinical thinking, but least useful when they're used to oversimplify complex decision making. That, as Neil's alluded to, comes to decision making at the bedside, evaluating the patient, looking at the films, and ultimately seeing what's best for those patients. So, thank you, Neil. Always a pleasure to pick your brain and get your insight and your, eloquent summaries of the data. So, thank you very much, Neil, and thank you, Ash, for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, gentlemen. It was great. Enjoyed it.